a Wednesday afternoon, and at 4:30 I need to be excused to go introduce the High Desert Museum.
Well, let's all go to the High Desert Museum.
Yeah, they're serving refreshments, so we have a long agenda, and you didn't have much of a voice, so I was hoping that you could remain.
For a bit.
All right.
I got a 5:15 appointment.
Okay. We'll get going then. We don't have a quorum right now, but we will shortly, but we can take public testimony. So we'll begin by opening the public screen as a subcommittee to take public testimony on House Bill 2612, and I'd invite Floyd Krasansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The bill that's before you, 2612, is being brought to you. This is, let's call it a debt and stuff that was agreed to by the original sponsor of the bill after we learned that the original bill was not going to be able to be addressed because of some other concerns and problems that were brought for my committee's attention. At that point in time, we had this bill available for any other type of issue that might have come up during session. What I have had handed out to you is a copy of an article from the Daily Emerald, which is the University of Oregon's newspaper, and it was dealing with a topic or a situation where an individual co-ed was in her dormitory room at night. She was sleeping at the time. Another student who resided in the dormitory but on a different floor let himself into the room, which apparently she had gone out to go to the restroom, came back to the room, closed the door, failing to lock the door. An individual made entry by coming through the door and then decided that he, for whatever purposes, decided to masturbate in the room while she was there sleeping. She woke up at some point in time while this act was taking place, startled the individual defendant, who made haste to leave the room, and she was able to leave the room and make identification of the individual, who was later brought to trial. I had received a call from a reporter with the Emerald, who is the individual who actually wrote the article that's before you, and had the questions to me as to what were we doing to address this problem, as well as what did I know about the problem. I assured her that I had never heard of the situation before, and my review of it, and after reviewing the article that she had written after my discussion with her on the phone, it seemed quite apparent to me that we had I'm going to call it a loophole or a void within our current criminal law, which I feel that needed to be addressed. And I brought this to the chair of the House Committee. He agreed that this was an area that we should work on, and so we did, in fact, put together what is now before you as House Bill 2612A in gross. Now, what we are attempting to do is to maintain that an individual has some type of reasonable expectation of privacy within certain confines that they may find themselves, such as in their residence, in their yard, or even in a place of employment, where they should not be was no pun intended, exposed to this type of conduct. And what we have attempted to do is address that by creating what would be a new law of private indecency and try to mirror closely as we could to the public indecency statute. And I want to share with you that I know that Ingrid Swinson will be speaking. She and I spoke briefly before the committee meeting today as to some concerns that she has raised. And I want to put on the record that I agree that there could be some modification in the language to, let's say, tighten up the language. Specifically, I will go through those parts that I know that she will be raising to your for your attention.
Ingrid, why don't you come forward right now? That might be the easiest thing. If you're in agreement on this, as you have to touch on it, as soon as you can get together and draft the amendments, that would be appreciated.
Okay. On page 1, line 13, Ms. Swinson brought to my attention that the language that was used, and this was drafted by our staff counsel at my request, where it says the person knows or should know. The term or should know is something that we have not used in the Oregon statutes for criminal conduct and for responsibility. And so we would more than likely be submitting language that would be that the person knowingly, which would be much more in line with what we currently have. The other area of concern on this bill would include on page 2 under the registration for sexual offenses. I will be asking the committee to delete any attempt of this crime of public indecency, which is found on line 18, which is the or end. And also that I believe that it would be only appropriate that if we're going to institute this type of offense that's going to require registration, that the person who has been previously convicted be placed on notice and not be retroactive. And so I expect that you'll see some language that will make the offenses in the future to be subject to registration and not looking back in time, because as it's been explained to me, and I also know from my own experience as a prosecutor, some people in some cases will have actually pled out to this offense in prior years, understanding that they would not be subject to this type of registration. It only seems appropriate and fair that it would be prospective, not retro. The other area of concern which we will need to work on is a concern that Ms. Swenson has brought forward as to any situation that you have consenting adults who are living in a cohabitation situation, either married or partners, where one of them decides to, let's say, maybe in a more playful way, but becomes very annoying to the other, exposes themselves for sexual gratification. And her concern is that do we really want to include those individuals? I'm not sure what we can do in the way of the language. It may be some type of exception or exemption for individuals that are cohabitating. My only concern might be in the domestic violence situation, but it would seem to me in my brief discussions with Mrs. Swenson that if someone is actually reaching that level, they would be faced with other additional type of charges. Now, the reason that the other reason I brought 2612 as A and gross to this body to be dealt with is because when you read the article, if you have an opportunity, Paul Gravener, who was the assistant district attorney in Lane County, who prosecuted this case, was in fact able to get the individual convicted of burglary and I believe also criminal trespass. The bottom line, though, is that that individual was involved in a sexual act that was not designated for any purposes in the future as such. And it seems appropriate from my discussions with other individuals that it's appropriate to have individuals that are committing these type of offenses to be charged with an appropriate crime that does in fact include sexual conduct. I do want to just throw the record, because I don't know if they're here or if they will be testifying. The part about registration, this was came, I believe, out of some testimony we had on other bills before the House Judiciary Criminal Law Committee, dealing with individuals that have committed much more aggravated sexual crimes. Apparently there's a study, I believe, out of the state of Arizona that has reflected that 70% of the people who have been convicted of these more serious aggravating sex crimes, their original convictions when it came to sex crimes were public indecency. So I do believe that there is a rationale for having some type of registration required. But as I previously mentioned, I don't think we should go back in time. It should be prospective as compared to retroactive.
From the chair's point of view, I think an exception for cohabitation makes sense. Otherwise, it puts the DA in a difficult position when there's an argument, and I would strongly recommend that. So as I understand the registration requirement that's being proposed, you'd only register if previously you've been convicted of a sex crime as outlined here. Is that correct?
It would be of these sex crimes, or it could be because of the actual crime of public or private indecency. It just would not go, would not be couched. If you look under N on page 2, it requires that the person has had a prior conviction for those offenses. So we only think it would be appropriate that it would be from the date forward once this bill is passed and signed and is operative. The other part...
If this, my question, though, would be if they have a conviction of private or public indecency, and none of these other crimes, no prior record, would they be subject to registration then?
And they, Mr. Chair, if I understand the question and my understanding of how the language has been written, it would be based on a second conviction of one of those two offenses. The other part that I do believe is appropriate to take out is the attempt. It just seems to me that if we're looking at this level of offense, not to downgrade its seriousness, but the appropriateness of based to the other charges that would require registration, then an attempt for that particular offense would not be appropriate.
Also, as I look at A through M on the sex crime, all of those require sex registration now, don't they?
I believe that's correct.
Yes, all right. Good. Not good. I understand what's going on. Ingrid, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ingrid Simpson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Representative Pozanski has presented our position much more artfully than we were.
Well, when the amendments are ready, why don't you let Mr. Taylor know and we'll reschedule the bill.
We'll do it. Thank you for your time.
With that, we'll close the public hearing now on House Bill 2612. Okay. We're going to do a few things in work session while we have a quorum, and then we can take public testimony with or without a quorum on the remainder of the bill. We have scheduled two items for reconsideration. Why don't we go to those?
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Which is,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you have before you two bills for reconsideration. One is Senate Bill 1168. This bill passed out, I believe, on Monday. It relates to the issue of Representative Courtney. I think actually outside dogs and cats. Far, in fact, you may remember we had a discussion after the hearing on whether a fur is hair or a hair is fur. But the bill also had a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee of the bill as originally drafted. Pardon the expression, it got the stuff.
This is the gotten stuff first.
But we do have before you a new set of amendments, the dash four amendments, which would clarify that the fur was obtained in a process that would fill or name the dog.
You want me to move to
reconsider?
I move that we reconsider the vote by which we passed out Senate Bill 1168 as amended.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves to reconsider the vote by which we passed out Senate Bill 1168. Discussion, objections, and ordered. Senator Courtney.
Now, the bill's before us or not?
I believe the bill's before us. Is that true?
Okay, we move the referral to within
the All right. I would now move that we move the referral to Senate Bill 1168 to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves that we remove the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on Senate Bill 1168. Discussion, objection, ordered. Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 1168.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves that we adopt the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 1168. Would you like to say anything on
yes,
the dash four?
Yes, I would. I hope everybody's listening, Senators, because this has been the week that was for me. These amendments, in effect, say that we're not going to allow in Oregon, if it passes, the sale of dog or cat fur for
commercial use,
which means installments and things like that. Having said that, the issue that arose after we passed it out was apparently there's a certain kind of dog and cat, and I can't remember the names. I was thinking albacore, and they said that's a tuna.
Malamute.
The Malamute is a dog, an Andorra. Albacore, I knew it was that they said cornice. And you comb through their hair, and then their hair is used to make maggots and things. So we don't want so to take care of that situation, we have added the situation a person may not take, buy, sell, barter, otherwise you save them a little bit. That's where the fur goes out. If the fur is obtained through the process for kills or maims, the cat or dog, we did think by using the word hair, we could make the distinction that we're going to counsel that. But rather than fool around with it, we talked, we added those words. So does everybody understand what we're trying to do here? Does everybody understand enough to know that you're not going to stand up in Senate floor and ask me difficult questions? I'm looking at my fellow members that I have gone to war with.
Senator, that is a challenge.
No guarantees.
Well, that's all I can say. Now, I just want to know something.
Right.
How does the chair feel about the amendments and the bill?
Warm and cuddly.
Okay.
Any objection to the aforementioned? Hearing none, so ordered.
I move Senate Bill 1158 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion? Objection, so ordered. Senator Courtney will carry this bill.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, next bill for reconsideration is House Bill 2216, requires an offender in post-prison supervision to reside for the first 6 months in the county where the offender resided at the time the offense was committed. Learned counsel was not so learned in this one, Mr. Chairman, as a committee. At the last meeting, I said that I thought this applied to both parole and post-prison supervision. We had another bill up before us, 2213, that applied to post-prison supervision, parole. And this sort of can apply to post-prison supervision. They are, parole is when you're sentenced prior to sentencing guidelines, you're getting released, you're released on parole. And the sentencing guidelines, when you're released on post-prison supervision. So, in fact, we need to adopt the Dashmore amendments before us so that a person, determine the person's county of residence for the purpose of this subsection, the board may not consider the offenses committed by the person while the person was incarcerated in the Department of Corrections facility.
The chair then would move that the House Bill 2216, the vote by which we sent it to the floor to pass, be reconsidered and the bill brought back to committee. Discussion?
Is this the one we didn't amend yesterday?
Yes.
Monday.
Objection ordered. The chair then would move the Dash 1 amendments. Is that correct, Mr. Taylor, to House
That's
Bill
correct,
2216? Be adopted. Discussion? Objection supported. Okay. Chair then would move House Bill 2216 as amended to the floor to pass.
Oh, yeah.
Discussion, objection. I believe Senator Cuto.
That was
Senator Burke.
No, Senator Burke got one and I got the other.
Which one has this?
I don't know which
Senator Burke. All
right. Don't you try to take it away from me.
I'm not trying to take it away from you.
Okay.
No questions on the floor either.
You may need me to help you carry it. Not because, you know, I don't need to have any kind of sense of it.
We'll now go into work session on Senate Bill 196.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 196 was introduced by the State Treasury early in session, and you had a very brief hearing at which time you were told that the Treasury and the Bankers Association were working on amendments to completely replace the bill. You have those as the dash threes in front of you, and I understand that Darren Bond from the Treasury and Tim Martinez from the Oregon Bankers Association are here to let you know what they've done.
They come forward, please. And I don't have the dash three. I do. I did find them. I'll take that back.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. This was the bill that you had a hearing on where Darren and I testified from the first row. Basically, you told us just to go out and come back when we had some sort of agreement. The bill deals with public fund deposits and the collateralization thereof. We had hoped to have a broader bill before you, but we simply are running out of time in this session. So I'll let Darren talk about the two pieces that we have agreed to. We know of no opposition, and we are going to work together in the interim to see if we can expand it. I'd also tell you, Mr. Chairman, that you and this committee have gone a long ways yet again. Earlier this year, I sat up here with Pam Levitt. Today, I sit up here with the Treasurer's Office, and that hasn't always been the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks. I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. Senate Bill 196, along with the amendments, is intended to strengthen Chapter 295, the Public Funds Collateralization Statute. It provides language to ORS 295 to ensure that it complies with the federal law relative to the Treasurer's ability to attach securities that are pledged by financial institutions against public funds deposits. It also provides for an industry standard methodology of pledging securities and makes various technical amendments.
ORS 295 requires that public funds depositors ensure that those funds are collateralized when they deposit them at a financial institution. It also requires that the financial institution pledge collateral to the treasurer, and it describes the manner within which the parties will act relative to these actions. The first change in Section 1 of the amendments addresses the need for ORS 295 to comply with the Financial Reform Recovery and Enforcement Act, commonly called FIREA. We've amended the definition of depository bank to include that a bank must enter into a written agreement with the treasurer's office. The written agreement must be approved by the board or the bank's loan committee, and it must be maintained as an official record of the institution. The courts have consistently held that these three components are critical to enforce the collateralization agreement in the face of an FDIC or other regulatory closure of an institution. The second change is technical but important and corrects and clarifies that when funds are invested under ORS 295, or it states when funds are invested to meet the exemption under ORS 295. Currently, 295 provides that invested funds don't have to be collateralized. Often it can be difficult to know when funds are invested, particularly when we invest them underneath an investment contract where we're transferring funds to a third-party investment provider. This clarifies that at the time of such transfer, the investment has been made. It was recommended by the Department of Justice attorneys that work with us relative to our investment contracting activities. The other significant element is the repeal of ORS 295.095. This eliminates the current matrix-driven process for valuing the collateral that's pledged by the institutions and replaces it with a market-driven approach. Currently, the treasurer convenes a group of people called the Valuation Committee on an annual basis. They put together a pricing matrix that's used by the institutions, the custodians, and treasury to value collateral. It had a place at a point in time when the secondary market for municipal securities was virtually non-existent, pricing was hard to come by. Today, there's a huge amount of information on all types of securities. There's a ready market for most municipal instruments. And this provides the pricing, so the market information is available, it's accurate, and it's a much more efficient way to price. The remaining changes are technical. We recognize that a public corporation and a municipal corporation is different. The correct language relative to certain high ed funds that are invested relative to student loans, and makes other conforming changes to bring existing statutes in line with the changes outlined in this bill. Other than what Tim said, we have attached an emergency clause recognizing the legislation that's being passed that will change the effective date to January 1, 2000. And this will allow us, by making the bill effective October 1st, to not have to call the Valuation Committee together one more time, and the fruits of their labor would only be good for a couple months. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the witnesses? Thank you. With that, the chair then would move the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 196. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. The chair then would move Senate Bill 196 to the floor do pass.
As amended.
Discussion? Objection?
Ordered.
Go ahead. I'll do it.
All right, Senator Gravel, carry it. Thank you.
This is the one that has here on. You can't do that right now. Right. That's had some disagreement with it. So, we could do 804, couldn't we?
Yeah.
And 804?
804 is ready, isn't it? We did it. Okay.
Okay. All
right.
Yes, I voted yes.
Would you, without objection, would you record Senator Courtney of the yes on Senator?
Thank you very much.
Public hearing then on House Bill 2436. And invite Ingrid Swenson, Bob Yunda, to report.
I'll do that.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center, and before you is House Bill 2436, which is a bill that would require the transfer of people who are in jail who have been found unable to assist in their defense because of a mental disorder. It would require those people to be transported to the state hospital for care and treatment, normally within a three-day period and with some exceptions for extension under certain circumstances. This bill is a response to problems that have cropped up in which people who have been found by a court to be unable to proceed with their criminal charges have remained in jail for weeks and sometimes months awaiting transport. We think this is a good bill. We think it serves both the state interest in moving people to trial and serves the individual's interest in assuring that people with mental illness do not remain in jails without treatment and care. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we certainly support this bill as well for many of the reasons that Mr. Junduff has just outlined for the committee. We do have clients who spend lengthy periods of time in jail simply awaiting a bed in the state hospital. That doesn't assist their interest in any sense, and certainly doesn't assist in the timely trial of their cases either. They need to be in treatment, and they need to be under circumstances in which their condition can improve so that they can return to court in a timely way.
And as I understand the process, we opened a new wing at the state hospital, so they have room at the moment, but if there wasn't room, it doesn't force someone out of the state hospital. That person still must remain at the local level, or what happens if there's not sufficient room?
Sure, Senator Bryant, the way the bill is constructed is that the hospital will have time to make room. It doesn't require them to move anyone out, and it doesn't prohibit them from finding treatment resources outside of the state hospital. But what it does do is it makes sure that that individual does not remain in jail while they have been found to be incompetent due to a mental defect.
But if there's not room in the state facility, what happens then?
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, or at least as listening to the testimony of the state superintendent of the hospital, that they have the ability, given some time, to move folks within their system to make room for the individual. I believe, and you might want to ask someone here who's testifying from the state perspective, that treatment resources can be located for individuals outside of the state hospital if the bed space is so restricted that they couldn't fit anybody else in.
Okay, because my concern would be, by passing the law, then forcing someone out the door who wasn't ready to be released yet, and using private facilities is fine as long as it's a secure situation if there needs to be security.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment, I think on the other end, what we do is house in our jails folks who really don't belong there for lengthy periods of time and have to release from the jails people that we wouldn't want to. So I guess there is a limited capacity in all of those institutions.
And I imagine there's a triage that's done by the hospital. Senator Cordy.
Well, this is very interesting. I wish Representative Maddox was here. I'm glad my newspaper's not here, because when you start releasing people from the state hospital, you know where the state hospital is located. I still don't think the question's been answered. What treatment, where, back in their communities? I mean, what are we talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, the state hospital, as you know, has a variety of wards. Some of the forensic wards, some are for non-forensic patients. and then there are private hospitals. As I understand it, the in terms of the individual, there can be different levels of treatment that they need. I don't believe that the state is by this bill is placing any obligation to release a person who might be dangerous.
Well, what you're saying, I got to interrupt. I'm sorry, because that's just the way I'm built. What you're saying is it's not going to happen because you're going to maneuver around that in that institution out there such that it doesn't happen. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, what I'm saying is that there's enough treatment resources in the state to move people to appropriate locations, yes.
Margie Johnson's here from the state hospital.
Mental health.
You came back from the tour, didn't you?
Yes.
You got to identify yourself.
Thank you. My name is Margaret Johnson, and I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. We have worked on this bill and through the House process have made provided a little more flexibility for the division, but I'm here to express the concerns of the agency with the potential fiscal impact of this bill. We certainly support the concept as speedy as a transfer as possible for the purposes of evaluating a prisoner in a local jail for their fitness to proceed with a criminal process. But depending on the census at the state hospital, in order to comply with the requirements of the bill, we may find ourselves in a position of having to try to find a way to open another ward. Because of the way the state hospital is regulated by the fire marshal and by other accrediting bodies, we don't have the flexibility to just keep putting one more person, for instance, on a particular living ward. And depending on where we are in our census at any particular time, this could create some problem for us because we do not discharge anyone from that program unless it's a planned discharge that's worked through very carefully with the Psychiatric Security Review Board. So, and that process takes some time. So while we have a little more flexibility in the amended version of the bill than was originally introduced with the 72-hour time limit, it still puts the constraints on the hospital in such a way that we may, in fact, have to incur extra costs in order to accommodate that.
Well, I know the intent is not to force someone out. And historically what's happened, if you were full, you just said no to the county, and the county had to find their own facilities, correct?
Senator Bryant, that's correct. What we did during the time when we were at capacity was to work with the individual sheriffs, county sheriffs, and jails to assess the situation of the individual inmate and the jail's capacity to provide some kind of mental health treatment in the local jail. And we triaged the situation across the state, took those inmates that, as we had capacity, that were coming from localities where there was no mental health treatment available in the local jail.
And as I recall, the E-Board action opened up another wing of 30 beds?
That's correct.
And what was the cost of doing that for the...
It on a biennial basis, it cost us about $3.6 million to operate a 30-bed ward.
And is that 30-bed ward full now?
No, it's not at capacity now. And I'm not sure right now what the census is, but it's approaching capacity.
Well, my thinking would be, one, we'd probably have to send it down the ways and need just to check the fiscal impact, but I would like a safety valve so if the capacity is full, that there's some discretion as far as what would happen.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm just sort of angry because I feel like at some point we're going to have to stop shuffling people. I mean, this is not a difficult problem to solve. It's a question of whether we're willing to put adequate resources into solving the problem. And we had Senate Bill 1007 up in front of us. We've had several bills, one particular in Deschutes County, to focus research on mental health issues, but you know, the reality is we're choosing not to solve this problem, and we're choosing to shuffle people around. And at some point, we're going to have to say no.
How many people do you think are currently in county facilities that would qualify under House Bill 2436?
Mr. Chair, at this point, I believe because of the extra capacity that was funded to the emergency board, that we've accepted any requests that county sheriffs have made to us for evaluation.
So there's no immediate influx that would be.
That's correct.
Required.
I guess.
Senator Kennedy.
The thing that makes me sort of sad is I support 942 and 941. 2942, which is going to start up a pilot program in your county and in Lane County, and I'm all for that. But I got Marion County, which is housing the Georgia State Hospital. And I wish Senator Jukup was here because I think Senator Brown made the most important remark, but I'm glad for the testimony of the person representing the hospital. This is a resource problem, and doggone it, you know, I'm sympathetic, but it is a resource problem. So I just hope somebody in the Ways and Means or somebody somewhere is still existing. Because I think you got only 30 beds is all you got. Is that it?
That's correct.
In the new wing.
In the new wing. And I got to tell you, I'll bet you in an instant they're gone once we go in this direction. Like, I'll bet you they're gone in an instant. I got to believe in these county jails, Mr. Chair, they'd be gone in a second. Maybe you don't think so.
I don't know. That's why I asked the question, how many
are in county jails right now? I don't know how many county jails you've got, but won't know the county alone.
Mr. Taylor has a preliminary statement that said the cost is indeterminable, especially since right now there is capacity with the new wing that's open at the state hospital. So sending it down the Ways and Means, we'll probably get that same answer. Senator Tarnas.
Bob Black. Your first page war paragraph is say currently there are approximately 20 pretrial inmates statewide waiting for up to 3 months for admission in the Oregon State Hospital. Are they in jail?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, just to direct to the sentence above, this I'm quoting here from a letter from Multnomah County Commissioner Lisa Nato. So as of September 18th, 1998, that was the case. And those people were in jail.
Were they formally charged?
Yes. These are people who have been charged with a crime. Upon appearance, their attorney has made a motion to the court and asked the judge to determine whether the person has the mental ability to go forward with their case, if they have the ability to understand the charges against them and assist their counsel. And for these 20 individuals, the judge ruled that they didn't have that ability and they needed some type of treatment in order to regain the ability who just faced their criminal charges. So these 20 folks were sort of put in a holding pattern until they got better enough to go to a criminal court and face their charges. And what's supposed to happen when the judge makes that decision is the judge gets to either put the person in a community treatment location to get that treatment or to send the person to the Oregon State Hospital. That's their choice.
Bob, in your opinion, have there been cases where a person was picked up because of mental illness and held in jail on charges that were not quite true? Not because of mental illness, mental incapacity, and inability to care for himself, he was held in jail?
Senator Tarnow, many people who have mental illnesses end up in the criminal justice system. Sorting out exactly what happened, it may turn out that the person didn't commit the offense. It may turn out that they did, but you never get to that point until the person is able to face the criminal charge. So it all sort of goes into a holding pattern until you're able to do it. When the person has to remain in jail, they don't get that treatment. They have the mental illness. They take up jail space. They suffer whatever pains that they might suffer from having a severe illness that isn't being treated. And there is no provision that right now to bring the resources to the jail to require them to be treated there. The only way to require them to be treated is to get them down to the hospital.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
One more. My concern is simply this, Bob, is that at some point in time, I think the state may face a very strong lawsuit from holding individuals in custody without having committed a crime, simply because there's no place to put them anywhere else. And to use a county jail as that holding facility for holding a mentally ill patient is totally wrong. And I'm just wanting to acknowledge if that's ever been proven to be the case.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, when this problem arose, we considered the legal angle. We talked with the mental health division and said that they were going to go to the E-board and find resources for another ward that could take care of the problem. They were true to their word. They got those resources. They've opened the ward. However, we went ahead with this bill because we were concerned with what might happen next. And in fact, as you've heard, there's concern voiced today that we may fill up that ward and be back in the same position again. So my short answer is that there may be legal repercussions to not moving people out of the jail.
What I would suggest, just so I can make an intelligent decision, Mary Ellen, if you could figure out what your inventory is right now, and then somehow do a census of the county jails just to see what the potential impact of this bill would be, realizing that local treatment's an option in some areas, and probably Multnomah County has more options in that way than others, but that we can get a realistic census of what the impact would be by passing this bill. And that will also cause us to maybe put pressure on the Ways and Means people to say, hey, there's another issue that's going to be here this biennium because you're going to have to open another wing or whatever the outcome might be.
Wait, sorry.
Bob, are you familiar with the Oregon State Hospital?
Yes.
You've heard it probably many times.
Many times.
It's not the most modern facility in the world.
That is correct.
Portions of it should be torn down.
I agree.
Now.
Let's go.
Well, I know what I'm really being very honest about in terms of opening more, can we just open another ward? That facility is very, I think you agree with me, Mr. Chair, it's not a state-of-the-art facility by any stretch of imagination. So I hear this, we'll just open another ward. This is my backyard, I know a little bit about it. I'm very sympathetic with this bill, but Jesus, bro, don't just say we're going to open another ward out there. It's got, I mean, that place, the cuckoo's nest didn't even begin to tell you about the place. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Except
the movie, Jack Nicholson is playing for
you. Not. I think we all caught that.
Guy, I wasn't sure because you didn't.
The Jack Nicholson wing. Thank you. If you could try and gather that information for me, then we'll reschedule the bill.
What are you waiting
for? We'll close the public hearing then on House Bill 2436. And. I made a note on it.
And
we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2599 and invite Representative Piercy and Mayor Torres.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm glad to be here to ask you to support House Bill 2599 and to have Mayor Tory here with me from Eugene to speak on behalf of this. When I came to the legislature two sessions ago, one of the things that I had on my plate was a determination to improve the attention our state pays to the thousands of runaway and homeless youth on the streets of our communities. I was and am acutely aware of the inadequacy of community services for this population and the gaping hole in available help for families who want the tools to keep their children safe and free from predation. I first became really involved in this issue on a personal level but even more so in my community after several young runaways had died under horrible circumstances. Many other others, particularly females, are lured into prostitution in exchange for food, shelter, and a modicum of affection. Children as young as 10 are out in communities without shelter and without caring responsible adults in their lives. It's unfortunate that the high level of abuse of our youngest children has meant that services to children and families have been unable to respond to our youth in trouble. The fact is that most of the young people out on the streets are fleeing abusive situations. A few are indeed choosing to be out on their own, even though they have supported families, but they represent a small percentage. In my opinion, allowing any of these children to be without responsible adult supervision is irresponsible and tantamount to child abuse itself. Currently, no state agency takes responsibility for the well-being of this population. In the last few years, some communities have begun to better address this population of runaway and homeless youth. In part, they've done that because these kids have been in our downtown areas and we have been forced to look at them. In part, because we have seen the results of youth violence and youth who grew up without a sense of responsibility for the well-being of their community and for the lives of those who live there. It seems to me when we allow a child to grow up uncared for, it is a stretch to expect that child to care for other people. The population of youth is not to be, this population of youth is not to be considered out of the continuum of care we need to provide for all of our children, nor outside of the need to provide our families with tools to raise their children successfully. If we succeed there, then this group will shrink to but a few. However, in the meantime, they are there and desperately need our attention and commitment to their welfare, for they will be parenting the next generation. This bill, House Bill 2599, addresses only a small part of a really large problem. I participated in discussions with a work group in my community and with another work group at the state level on juvenile issues. I heard repeatedly that law enforcement officers needed clarification in the current law as to the conditions under which a runaway or homeless youth may be taken into protective custody. House Bill 2599 is a result of these work groups made up of professionals who work with runaway and homeless youth, police officers, the ACLU, and local governments. This bill expands and clarifies the conditions under which runaway or homeless youth may be taken into protective custody. It allows officers to release the child to a parent or guardian, or if this is not an option, to take the child to a shelter facility that has been designated by the juvenile court to provide such care. It also specifically prohibits these children being placed in a facility that contains adjudicated offenders. This bill also allows the police officer to determine the best course of action by considering the preference of the child and the child's parent or guardian. Thank you for being here. I would also like to clarify the legislative intent of this bill. The language in Section 3A of the bill ensures that the services and resources developed for this population are distinct from the shelter systems in place to serve abused and neglected children. I wish they weren't so distinct, but they are. It is intended to bring our young people in contact with private, nonprofit services that are already available to them. After adding an emergency clause and a 2-year sunset, this bill was sent to the House floor where it passed with a unanimous 58-0 vote. Today, you have the opportunity to take a positive step to protect the young people of our state. After hearing from advocates, city officials, and others who have traveled here today, it's my hope that this committee will vote to send House Bill 2599 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
So, listen, Chrissy, I think this is great. Can I offer just one small suggestion?
Mm-hmm.
Because not only do law enforcement have a problem with these children who are lost and trying to detain what they call the fattest offense, they have problems with these children being harbored by individuals when the officers go there in response to information that a runaway juvenile is in this person's home. The person answers the door and says, no, this person is not here. The officers are dead cold. They can go no further. Would you be willing to a small amendment that says harboring a runaway juvenile could be a Class A or a Class A misdemeanor?
I certainly understand, Mr. Chair and Senator Turno, I understand this problem. I've heard a lot about it over the last few years, and I think that my concern would only be that if that were going to be such a complex issue for us to resolve, that it would slow down the process of this bill. I would be sorry for that to happen, but I certainly agree with you that that's a big issue and really needs our attention.
Okay, thank you.
Also, on the part that says that the child shall not be placed in a facility where adjudicated youth are detained. What if it's the type of facility where completely in the same facility but in a separate wing of where adjudicated youth are detained? And I reference Deschutes County has built a juvenile detention center, and it has 72 beds. 36 of those beds are for adjudicated youth. And their intent is to use one of those wings for non-adjudicated youth that are in trouble but haven't been adjudicated by the court. Would you have a problem with that as long as it was separate from the adjudicated?
I think, again, I understand the intention that these are separate populations. They would be dealt with separately, and I don't have a problem with that unless it becomes such a contentious issue because it brings so many people in with concerns that it makes this bill hard to move forward. Other than that, I'm certainly willing to consider this.
It has economies of scale because you can use the same kitchen staff and those sort of things, and it does offer some security, too. They're less likely to run away again.
Yeah.
Representative Mannix.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Kevin Mannix from Salem. I'm pleased to be here today with my colleague, Representative Piercy, and the mayor of Eugene in regard to this bill and to present to you my strong personal endorsement and also the strong support of the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law. We worked over this bill on the House side and tried to be very careful about the delineation of what's covered here so as to be sensitive to a variety of concerns, and I think those sensitivities are reflected in the language of the bill. In response to the last question, Senator Bryant, I think that the language of page 2 of the A. Gross bill at line 3, where it says, shall not place a child in any facility. Facility there does not necessarily mean a building complex or building. It really means an area, and that perhaps another phrase ought to be used there, or to get to the chair's intent. Certainly we were not trying to prevent Deschutes County from doing what you described. The idea was to make sure that we aren't putting these children in with adjudicated youth or youth who are charged with certain offenses. And frankly, the federal government has gotten much more open-minded about understanding that you could have different areas of complexes that are set aside. You could say, shall not place the child in any portion of a facility where a person is alleged, and that would make it pretty clear. And I don't think that would harm the legislation, and it would certainly be something we can quickly concur with. I'll let Representative Piercy comment on that before I jump to Senator Tarnow's concern.
My only comment is around your comment about we might be able to keep them there because the way current law exists, it's a voluntary. They are voluntarily there. We can't keep them there anyway. So it wouldn't be a lockup situation.
But probably, and I was thinking this, if they wanted to leave, they would have to go through some process of checking out.
Right.
And that would hopefully have them get some second thought about what they're doing.
Right.
And Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, if I could add that this is a soft approach to this issue. Some of us were willing to take a tougher stance that appreciate the sensitivity and the desire to make sure that we're cautious about how we approach the issue. As to Senator Tarnow's inquiry, I think that we've sent over a number of bills and we're sending a few more that are in the pipeline, more than a few, where you might find that you have a couple of other technical changes you want to make and they've got good relating clauses. You may want to build up some of those technical changes in one or two bills or additions. And in this case, it'd be more of an addition so that as many, I'll say, clean bills can be kept moving through the process. But that's certainly up to the committee, and I very much agree with Senator Tarnow's sensitivity on that point.
Thank you. Chair Torrey.
Senator Bryant, chairperson, and members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before you here today. I appreciate Representative Mannix and Representative Piercy's support of this bill. I think that this is probably one of the unique bills relating to what we call at-risk youth that you're going to hear, and that it was developed prior to the time that the Thurston incident started or took place. It actually came about as a result of a suggestion that a mayor in Eugene made that there ought to be a law that requires children to be in school during the day, and I was pushed around a little bit in my city. We're somewhat of a liberal community, and I agreed that since I couldn't make that happen, what I would do with Mayor Bill Morissette from Springfield, who's a former mayor, would call together a group of people in Eugene and Springfield to talk about the gaps in programming that were available to deal with the needs of youth in our community. And one of the major issues that came out of that meeting, and this was a large group of people who spent half a day talking about these needs, was the need to be able to remove a young person from a position of concern in the eyes of a police officer that was not now being removed. The police officer would look at a situation and say, wait a minute, can I really do this? I'm not sure I can do this. And as a result, I don't know where I would take the young person even if I did do this. And the officers were concerned that we were, in fact, doing a disservice to these young people. As a result of that, Representative Piercy headed up the committee of this group that took this issue on, and the end result is the bill you see before you today. But I would point out that it is also a recommendation not only of the city of Eugene and Springfield. It is the recommendation of the entire League of Oregon Cities. And it isn't just something where we went to a short meeting and said, will you support this in your legislative program? We took this bill along with a number of other youth-oriented bills around the state of Oregon. And in fact, one meeting was with the chairperson in Deschutes County. But we went to Grants Pass, we went to Pendleton, and to make a long story short, the mayors and the city councilors around the state of Oregon felt the same need that we knew existed in our community. There are instances where young people, as young as 12 and 13 years of age, are on some streets of Eugene being contacted by perpetrators that have no interest in those young people other than to use them. Whether it's to carry drugs or to be involved in some sort of form of prostitution. I really hope that you will give serious consideration and pass out this measure. This is not an arrest, and I would point out something else that's interesting. We knew, as a result of the recommendation of the subcommittee that Representative Piercy headed, that this was not going to be an adjudicated issue. This was a non-adjudicated issue. This was not an arrest. This was not going to appear on a young person's record. But we needed to find a facility to take these young people to. We went to the Rotary Clubs in Eugene, and in a short period of time, less than 2 months, they have generated over $45,000 to allow us to take children who are currently in some of our shelters and to find host families for those children to open up space in the Looking Glass facility to take these children on a short-term basis that are picked up. And this is assuming that you will pass out this legislation and that the Senate will support it. I greatly appreciate your consideration of this measure and want to again thank both Representative Mannix and Piercy for their support.
Thank you. Questions to the Senator Turner.
I'm just a little confused, Mr. Chair. With the mayor, I don't know how you would not say there's an arrest if you deprive somebody of their personal freedom. And maybe Kevin can address that.
I can probably help, Mr. Chairman. Senator Turner. Actually, in the classic constitutional rights sense, this is an arrest because somebody is, in effect, being detained. But in the sense of creating a record, which can be part of a juvenile record, it would not be treated as an arrest for an offense. They are being taken into custody, and in that sense, in that classic old-fashioned sense, you would call that an arrest. But it's not as part of any kind of a charge.
I'm reading that custodial interference. In the second degree, a person commits this crime. In the second degree, if knowing or having reason to know that the person has no legal right to do so. Here, I guess we're providing the legal right to do so. So that might alleviate it. Well, and there's a thank you valve in it that you don't have to take them to a shelter if there's no indication they're going to stay there. Too. Other questions?
Could I add one comment just for the record, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
The thing that always has motivated me is that we do have evidence that when a runaway child has intervention, the first or second time they run away, we have an 80, I believe it's of course, I'm going to answer this.
Over 80%.
But it's over 80% of them don't ever run away again if you get them to help and intervention the first or second time they run. And that's a very large percentage of kids that you can make a difference for just by putting that intervention in place. And I think that alone is worth doing this.
Can I ask a question? Maybe it's in here. What is the average age of those runaways you have in this country? You don't, that's fine.
Well, we don't have an average age, but if you were to walk down a certain street in the city of Eugene, which I'd be glad to give you if you want, but it ranges anywhere from 12 to 20, with a very small group of 25 to 30-year-olds who prey on these young people. I don't know how else to say it.
The reason I brought that up is there is another little issue going on in the Oregon legislature. Where we spend the money on our children. And I just, I had no idea where I was going with that question, but that's a very interesting answer you've given me, and I thank you very much for that information, Mr. Mayor. I can probably use that in the near future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, being a non-politician, I won't respond to that tonight. But I will say I strongly believe in a full continuum of
thank you.
Service.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. You and I got to get to know each other real well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, this is sort of out of line, but I'll mention there's two other bills up that I happen to be sponsor of, and I don't know if you care to hear from me about those. Or
why don't we do those right now? Which two are those?
One is 2436, and the other is 2464.
I will now close the public hearing temporarily on 2599 and open the public hearing on two bills, 2464. Representative Mannix.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Kevin Mannix from Salem, for the record. House Bill 2436 has to do with a seemingly simple issue, which is actually a significant issue for our folks, especially out there in the hustings. It has to do with the issue of having defendants transported to a state hospital when there's a court determination that the defendant lacks fitness to proceed. This is in a criminal case. I sponsored this legislation at the request of public safety authorities who run into problems coordinating with the state hospital in Salem as to maintaining such a defendant while that defendant is evaluated, while there's an attempt to see whether or not the person will be deemed fit to proceed. Long story short on that bill, Mr. Chairman, is that the language in the bill was crafted in cooperation with court authorities, in cooperation with the state hospital officials, and in cooperation with public safety officials from around the state, particularly Eastern Oregon, to try to work out a balanced system so that, to put it bluntly, they don't end up sending somebody to Salem and finding out there's no room at the inn and being told, well, we're sorry, we can't admit this person at this time. At the other end of the spectrum, to make sure that the state hospital has some notice that somebody's being sent to the state hospital because there's an issue as to fitness to proceed. House Bill 2464 is picks up on an issue which this legislative assembly previously addressed having to do with the elderly and legal protection for the elderly persons as to, I'll call it, predatory conduct as well as abandonment. And this bill expands the concept to include disabled persons so that they would have the same protections that we provide for elderly persons. You will hear today from advocates for the disabled who will explain how this kind of protection would not only be very helpful, but actually is very much needed in this state. Fortunately, it only is needed in a limited number of situations and cases, but when it is needed, Mr. Chairman, it is very much needed, and I urge your consideration of the measure. I appreciate your having set it for hearing today.
Thank you.
Thank you
for everything, man. Thank you for your testimony. With that, we will close the two public hearings on House Bill 2436 and House Bill 2464. And while I have the necessary votes here, I will open the work session, and then we'll go back to 2599. I haven't forgot about the other witnesses. You'll have your opportunity. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 847.
Mm-hmm.
And this week,
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 847 exempts personnel evaluations from public disclosure by putting them in a statute that you are all very familiar with now, and that is the public records balancing test statute. And the effect of that is that the evaluations would be exempt from public disclosure unless the public interest required disclosure in a particular instance. And you may remember testimony to the effect that current law, or currently in the same statute, personnel discipline actions are exempt, but this bill adds personnel evaluations to that statute.
Are there any amendments to...
There are not.
And this bill comes to us at the request of the League of Oregon Cities and Counties and Special Districts. We are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2599.
I believe Senate Bill 847. Senator Q-Tub moves Senate Bill 847. Discussion? Objection.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to object.
Yeah. Would you please record Senators Brown and Senators Courtney as objecting? Motion carried. Senator Q-Tub, would you carry the bill, please?
Sure.
Thank you. We will now go back to public hearing on Senate Bill 2599. And I'll invite Barbara Golden, Sonia Spencer, and Barbara Schrager. Schrager, I was close, to come forward. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You can identify yourself for the record and begin, please.
My name is Barbara Golden. I thank the senators for listening to us as parents come up here and speak to you. My son has been a runaway. He is now in a program that I have taken his college fund money to place him in, out of state, which has counseling and behavior modification and school, and he'll probably be there for a year or so. I've already spent his college fund money, which is $23,000 so far. The reason I'm here is because my son did start running away in August of 98, and he just started on a downward spiral. He'd come home once in a while and then leave again. He was arrested a couple of times. One time I picked him up, the other time, and he ran away right after I picked him up. The next time he was at a Shopko shoplifting CDs to make money to live on the streets, I guess. And I went to pick him up there and tried to talk to him, tried to tell him that I loved him and I wanted him to come home, that he needed to live by some rules and not live in the streets and not do drugs and those things. He chose to start yelling, and it provoked the police officer, which was there, and they took him to Skipworth, our facility in Lane County. At that time, I talked to the intake people, and I tried to get him help. We've been going through counseling for off and on since he's been in second grade because his father hasn't been present in his life, most of his life. So I've been doing this on my own. And I even changed my schedule at work. My bosses were wonderful enough. When things started getting bad this year, and he started running away, I was able to switch my schedule so I could take him to school, pick him up from school, and things like that. But that didn't seem to help because he'd already gotten into the drugs, I think, too bad. But anyway, when the intake counselors, I spoke to them and tried to get him help through the mental health system. I had tried on other occasions taking him to Sacred Heart or going through his doctor to get him psychiatrically evaluated to see if there was something wrong that way. The two times at Sacred Heart, the mental health people came down, and once they found out we were in counseling and they talked to him, and he said, oh, yeah, I just want to go home and go to bed, and things are cool. They gave him a prescription for Prozac and said, this is just normal teenage behavior. There just aren't a lot of things out there for parents, and I think this bill would be really great in helping us to protect our children. I know that Station 7, which is part of Looking Glass in Eugene, they helped quite a bit. My son went to that shelter a few times, and at least when he was there, I was notified, and I could sleep those nights that I knew he was safe. And they tried to get him working in a system to get off the streets. Since things didn't work out that way, the Shopko incident and the Lane County juvenile system worked with me, and we gave him the option of going into this treatment facility or being on probation or going to jail, and he chose, thank goodness, to go into the treatment facility. But so many parents don't have that option, and I don't really even have that option. I'm going to be borrowing money for years, I'm sure, to pay for this. But my son is very important to me.
He's 16 now.
He is now 15. He just turned 15 March 30th. So. He seems to be doing better. And I haven't seen him since I had him placed there January 25th. And I won't be able to see him until he makes a certain level, that he's one step away from that level. Anyway, I am just very pleased at this bill. I think it would really help to be notified by the police, either that they were being brought home or that they were going to a shelter where they could get some help. As a parent, it's just a horrible feeling to not know where your child is and to be worried that they could be dead or doing some criminal act or hurting someone else. So I think that this is good.
Thank you for the testimony. And if I could ask you to step aside just for a moment, we have another senator here who I believe wants to testify on the bill. Susan, why don't you come forward, and then you can rejoin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. I just wanted to come and express my support for this legislation. I have had constituents in my district call parents who have had runaway children who feel totally helpless. They can't turn to police and ask them to go, and even if they know where their child is hanging out in our community, there's no way that police have the authority now to go and pick up their kids and at least get them to a safe place or do some kind of assessment for them, and parents are feeling so helpless. If we can pass this and this can help make a difference for those families, it would be terrific, and I just wanted to come and express my support. Representative Piercy and our mayor have worked very, very hard trying to come up with legislation that they thought could be helpful and yet didn't go, didn't treat these youth like criminals, but at least helped to create a process for keeping them safe while they're away from their home. And so this seems like a good compromise, and I just urge you to support this. Thank you.
Thank you. Sonia?
Yeah. I'm Sonia Spencer. I'm a parent. I'm in support of the bill. My daughter is on the streets right now, and it's, except for a phone call from a shelter house here in Salem last night, I haven't heard from my daughter in 2 months. And like Barbara said, it's the worst feeling. I have a 14-year-old girl out on the streets who chooses not to be home because she doesn't want to be in the house at 10 o'clock. And she just wants her own rules. And my daughter has been picked up. I've been doing this for 2 years since my daughter was 12 years old. She's been picked up several times, and I haven't been contacted. She's around known gang members. Police have been into homes where she has been in that they know are gang houses. And unless they catch her with something on her, they have no authority to take her out of the home, and they've turned and left her in this home with these people. Now, I'm at 34 and looking at being a grandmother, and it's just, it's a step to where parents can have contact with somebody who has seen their child. And they can know that, you know, that they are still walking. And my daughter has been in the shelters a couple times, and they have helped her, you know, come home for a while. And she's so far along now that it's, I don't feel a lot of help for her until she's ready to change. But I feel that we would have had something in force when she was a runaway the first or second time. Maybe we could have gotten her before she got into the main circulation of people. And so I'm for this bill because it's a means for contact for parents and getting parents and the shelters maybe time to help these kids before they get too far into what they're out there doing. So, thank you.
Thank you, Rita.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I am a mother of a hopefully former runaway. I am also a member of United Parents for Runaway and Homeless Youth. I myself and another mother created this group because there was nowhere to turn. There was no one that understood the problem. People would just say, we're bad parents. You can't control your child, you're a bad parent. When you have a child who is bigger than you are, you know, you have totally lost control if they don't choose to do what you want them to do. Anyway, a few months before my son turned 16, he started sneaking out of the house at night. One night he was with some friends who were playing chicken with cars on Main Street. Some police officers stopped them. Two of the kids lived about a mile from where they were stopped, and so the officer called their parents. My son and his girlfriend were only about 3 blocks from home, and so the officer just told them to go home. I was not informed of that contact or the fact that he was sneaking out until much later. One day he decided he didn't have to follow the rules anymore, and so he ran away. That night I was awakened by a police officer telling me that my son and some of his friends had broken into an empty apartment and caused some damage. He was just held in a room until he was processed, and then they got him home. He thought that that was really a great adventure with no consequences. Once he went to Corvallis with the family, even though I told them that I did not want him taken out of town. I tried to get help from the police, but they told me that he went with those people of his own free will, so they couldn't do anything. It took me 2 months to get him back home again. Another time he ran away, someone told me they overheard him saying that he had alcohol and marijuana and was going to Cougar for a party. That scared me to death. Cougar is not a place a parent would want their child to be, and definitely not with drugs and alcohol. He was gone for 3 months. I was sure he was dead. Then one morning I received a call at 3 a.m. from my son saying he was sick and would I please come get him. I picked him up and took him to the doctor. He stayed home 3 days and ran away again. He had been living with a family only 7 blocks from home. He had been picked up by the police and ticketed for jaywalking. Again, I was not contacted, even though I had filed a runaway report. Each time the police had any contact with my son, they deleted the report, and I had no idea of where he was. It was very stressful not knowing where he was or even if he was alive. In my son's case, police had contacted him several times, but they did not contact me. At least with Bill 2599, parents would be contacted. If this bill had been enforced while I was going through the worst of it with my son, I would have had a little more peace of mind just knowing he was alive and well. It seemed everywhere I turned for help, there was nothing available. My son was not bad enough to warrant any help from any agency. House Bill 2599 is a small step towards helping parents get a handle on some of these kids. At least it will help get a kid out of a bad situation at the moment. It is not a perfect solution, but at least it is a start. This bill will be nothing to help my situation since my son is now 18 years old. But there are a lot of young children out there on the streets who are making very poor choices. This bill is a step in the right direction towards helping these children and their families. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh. Other questions? Thank you for your, I'm sure, a very painful personal testimony. Thank you. I understand we have some, I don't know all the names, Ben, well, if you're from, could you step forward? I think it's about 3 or 4 of you. And if I start to do some of the names, then you'll all get upset with me because I don't pronounce the names right. So, okay.
Chief. The reason the chair left is he's in Vandum. He's carrying down business for a few minutes about high debt that he's in. So he'll be right back, so I should probably say that because I know that he represents Vandum. So please forgive him for having to leave just for a few minutes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, committee members. For the record, my name is Deirdre Mims Casperger, and I'm one of the program managers for a program in Bend called JBARJ Youth Services. I'm the program manager at an agency called Cascade Youth and Family Center, and we are the primary service providers for runaway and homeless youth in Deschutes and Jefferson County. I have brought with me today a couple of adolescents who have personal experience as being filed as runaways. They have a bit of a different perspective that I think will be appreciated. As we see it within our agency, there are two sides to this issue. Both sides of the issues are safety issues. Obviously, there are safety issues and concerns in regards to youngsters and the self-harm that they may do to themselves as being runaways. We have numerous examples of youth who are involved with drugs and alcohol and who are on the streets and are making very poor choices. I think that the other side of that issue is that there are generally reasons why adolescents run away from home, and I think that these two youth can speak quite well to that side of this issue, and they both are in favor of the bill and would like to speak in support of it. So I've brought with me Matthew Pilch and Michelle Cooper, and Matthew's going to start.
Good afternoon. Like she said, my name's Matt Pilch, and just on a quick side note, as Ms. Golden said, that's a real unfortunate circumstance, and I totally support that side of it. This afternoon, though, I do represent the other side of that. I have a bit of a different story. 2 years ago, when I was 16, I was asked to leave my home due to extenuating family circumstances, and just 2 months after that, I was picked up while attending school and charged as a runaway. And I was taken to a detention center and released to my mother, who at the time I found out had wanted to take me to a treatment center in Utah. And at that time, there was not enough time to contact Cascade Youth and Family or an attorney. And what this bill would do would have allowed them to make a judgment call on whether it was safe or not to go back with my mother. Not everyone runs away. I know that there are many who do, but because of maybe emotional or physical abuse in the family, or the parents don't like the kids, they're asked to leave, or maybe the kids do run away because of fear. And I think this bill would definitely assist both the kids as well as the parents. My mother wouldn't let me go into court, even though we had petitioned. Just a few days after I was taken to the detention center, I was picked up again at school after I'd been released to my mother, and we had had an emergency court hearing set, and she wouldn't let me get out of the car. And from then, I was taken to Pacific Gateway Hospital in Portland in a treatment center, and I was admitted. I was admitted there, and you know, it's a lockdown facility, and it was later deemed that I wasn't even, I don't know how you'd say, qualified to even be in there. Their qualifications were for suicidalness and whatnot, and so it was later proven that I didn't need to be there, but too late. If the bill had been in effect at that point, the first time I had been picked up, they could have deemed me to go directly to a foster care program or directly contacted somebody else, and the time could have been taken to assess the situation and evaluate it. And I believe that's what page 293, section B of this bill refers to. And I'm not sure how I would have felt had I been taken to the detention center with, as you had mentioned earlier, adjudicated youth or into a special ward. I wouldn't have minded so much the fact that they would look into this situation, that they would do checks and not immediately release myself or other people into the parents. Had Deschutes County not been able to do this, had they not been able to intervene, who knows where I would have been. I could have ended up in Utah as originally planned, or who knows. As it was, I was admitted into the treatment center where I was held until the state deemed me safe to be released under the state's jurisdiction. So I am very in favor of this bill, as it will help the youth as well as the parents.
Thank you.
My name is Michelle Cooper. I'm 17, and about 1.5 years ago, I was given into my dad's custody, and I moved in with him. My father failed to provide financial support. I had to pay for, you know, clothes, heat in my bedroom, bath, schooling. He also failed to provide emotional support and many times was emotionally abusive to me. It ended up to where he was preparing to force me to quit school and take a full-time job in order to support myself. And if I had refused to do this, he would have prevented me from moving to college. My education was really important to me, and I felt that he was not supporting me in this. I felt trapped, and my health was getting neglected. He was failing to provide me with medical treatment, and my grades were dropping. And because of this, I sought counsel just to get someone to provide an outside view on it that was unbiased, that could give us counsel on how to go about dealing with this problem. My father was very much against counseling with anybody on the issue and became very volatile towards me because I tried involving Cascadia's and family in counseling with us. Because of his behavior towards me and his emotional, verbal threats over the phone, I asked that I not be taken back home. Because of this, my father reported me as a runaway. I was apprehended by a police officer at school, and I told her the situation in which I was in, but because of the fact that my father had custody of me, he was the only one that I could be relinquished to. Even though I told the officer that there was emotional abuse involved and that I was scared to go home, she was bound by law to take me back to my father's home. This was like really alarming to me, and I was very upset about this. And by passing the bill, if this bill had been in effect, I would have had the choice if authorities, if the police officer or Cascadia's and family had seen fit that I should go into shelter, I would have had that option instead of returning to my father. By passing this bill, the police department, shelters, and other agencies that seek to help troubled youth will be allowed to more accurately assess the situation in which the child is in and provide more beneficial aid. This will be done by protecting these youth more actively. By not allowing a child this option of seeking shelter, we may risk the possibility of that child taking drastic measures in order to avoid being returned to the custodial guardians. Also, I may point out in my case of claims of emotional abuse, it's very hard to determine whether or not a child is in danger when emotional abuse is involved. And unless the child is able to be put into care of a shelter and assessed through a period of time, it would not be able to be determined whether or not that child was in danger or not. The amount of time a police officer is given when they take a child into custody and when they have to return the child to the custodial parent is not enough to determine whether or not the child is in danger. So the bill really helps my situation, especially in Section 1.3d, in which it states that the people, the authorities involved can determine whether or not to return the child to a shelter or to the parents instead of just being forced to return them to the parents. So I strongly advocate this bill and would be very pleased if it be passed.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Sure.
Michelle, how old were you when your father took over custody?
I was 16.
16. So it was high school that you were going to?
Yes. Yeah.
And you made reference to having costs associated with school.
Yes.
Did you go to public school?
I went to public school, but my father moved me midterm to a school that could not provide a foreign language, and I needed to go to the community college in order to fulfill my foreign language so I could be accepted into a university.
And I had to pay for that because my father refused to pay for it.
Matt, just to clarify, it's Matt, right?
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify the situation. Your mother asked you to leave?
Yes.
Okay. And so. Okay. Thank you very much for the testimony.
Questions?
On my part. I'm the chair, and I just wanted to thank him.
Thank you. Thank you for coming over from Ben. Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, we have Kathy and Timothy now. I think we'll hear from Kathy.
I want to hear from Tim. His chair.
You'd have to know about Tim and Peter to know what that's all about. It's something to do with the Boston Red Sox, the Yankees, and some, you know.
Thank you.
Kathy, why don't you go first, and then Tim can go second.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. For the Vice Chair's information, I'm a longtime Detroit Tigers fan, so I can see.
That's good. That's good, Jim.
I'm here in support of House Bill 2599. There are some changes that I think need to be made. However, in sitting through the testimony that we've been having, I think it points out one of the major problems is in this area, and it's this is an area with runaway and homeless youth that there are a lot of problems. Most notably is the lack of resources, but in this case, we're also seeing that there's a lack of training for the police. We're hearing that the Springfield police won't pick up kids, won't notify the parents, and won't return the kids to the parents. We're hearing that the Bend police say that they have to return the kids, they have to pick them up, and they don't have any discretion not to return them to the parents. The reality is that the police have a lot of discretion in the cases when they come in contact with homeless and runaway youth about what they can do. They can take the kids to a shelter facility. They can take the kids back to the parents. They can release the kids on their own recognizance. And they also can contact SDF and try to obtain services for these children. So there's a wide discretion of what can be done. So probably what we're seeing around the state is that different police agencies are handling this problem differently, which is creating some of the differences in the stories that you're hearing from the parents and from the youth about what they're being told by the police. The reality is that runaway and homeless youth, there is a problem with runaway and homeless youth in Oregon. We don't provide services for runaway and homeless youth. They're the most difficult of the clients that I work with. They're the most difficult kids to work with because what you get is you get agencies that refuse to deal with them and argue about who's actually responsible for these kids because they tend to be the older teenagers who have not committed a law violation and who are not real inclined to stay put and do what an adult tells them to do. So they are difficult. They are a difficult group to work with. When I touched on the House side, what I said about House Bill 2599, if you look at the problem of runaway and homeless youth in Oregon as the alphabet, and you want to get to Z is solving the problem, and you're at A, this is going to get us to B. Don't think it's going to get you to M. Don't think it's going to get you to P. It's not even going to get you close to those letters. What it's going to get you is to B. I think what we're going to find if this bill is passed by the Senate and signed by the governor is that the police will pick up the children, and when they try to take them to the facilities, they are going to find that the facilities are just not available or are a revolving door. I do have some suggested changes that we did suggest over on the House side, and they said, well, go over to the Senate and fix it. And Timothy, I know, also does. The suggestions that I had is that when they talk about runaway youth, it should also be added in homeless youth. Some of the youth that testified here testified that they didn't exactly run away. The technical term of runaway is you run away, your parents actually want you back in the house, and usually then the parents fill out the runaway report. Unfortunately, what happens with a lot of these kids is they are kicked out of the house, told to leave, or just don't really have a family to return to. That would not be technically a runaway child. You want to make sure that the police have the ability and don't have to be sitting there trying to determine while they're you know, looking at a 15-year-old child, whether this child technically ran away and therefore is not covered by this bill, or it's just a homeless youth and is not covered by this bill, which I don't think we really want. That's the distinction. We really want the police to get into at that point. We want the police to do something with this child to make sure this child is in a safe place. Then I think it would help us if homeless youth is added to this. I think this is there's nothing that this bill does that probably couldn't be done right now. What it does is it makes it clearer that what these alternatives are for the police department, which may help make sure that things do happen, and it also makes it clear where they should be taken. Senator Bryant mentioned about placing the child in a facility where children were alleged to have committed delinquent acts. Juvenile Rights Project would not be supporting this if they were allowed to be placed, if these runaway and homeless youth were allowed to be placed with kids who are alleged to have committed a delinquent act but have not been adjudicated. These kids should not be locked up. They have not alleged to have committed an unlawful act. Mostly what we're dealing with are family problems or mental health problems. Certainly there are ways that we can keep these kids secure in shelter programs that are staff secure. In other words, the doors aren't locked, but certainly the staff are going to try to dissuade a youth from leaving. But I don't think that these kids should be placed in a facility where they are actually locked up. That can be done after there's an adjudication of the kid, or if the child is found to be a dependent child and placed in the custody of FCF, there are provisions in our law that the child then can be placed in a locked facility. Most notably, Rosemont School for Girls up in Portland is a locked facility where dependent girls, not delinquent, they do also delinquent girls, but girls that are dependent and are chronic runaways are often placed. So it can happen after an adjudication. One of the problems is it's difficult to get a child, a runaway child, in most counties in the juvenile department and under the custody of FCF. I'm available for any questions.
Timothy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Timothy Travis with the Oregon Judicial Department. We are in favor of this bill. Many of you on this committee know that for the past four sessions I have introduced and advocated for bills to help runaway homeless children and their families, and I'm pleased to see one get this far, and I'm hoping it gets the rest of the way home. There are some technical problems with 2599 that I'd like to point out to the committee. Again, we were on the House side working. The consensus was fix it on the Senate side. One of the problems is that in Section 3 of the bill, there are a number of places in Section 3 of the bill where it talks about a shelter care facility. A shelter care facility is a defined term in the juvenile code. And it is not the facility, it is not Looking Glass. It is a facility that is intended to house kids while they are awaiting investigation and disposition. This bill has nothing to do with kids who are going to get investigations and dispositions in the juvenile court. My fear is that if you put shelter care facility in there, you're going to be getting into the facilities that are intended for foster kids and for kids who are under the custody of FCF. The second issue that I have has to do on the second page with lines 5 and 6, where it says that one taking these children into care shall follow the procedures described in 419B 160, 165, 168, and file the report in ORS 419B 171. No one who's associated with this bill has yet to explain to me why this is in here. It has been said that this will prevent the same kid from getting picked up twice. But I don't know how that's going to do that since these reports are not going to be on leads. If these reports are made, they're going to be filed at the juvenile court. No police officer will ever see them. And the problem with requiring these reports to all be filed is that they are reports that are sent to court counselors and courts. Well, currently, these reports are sent when a child is taken into care and you're going to have a case. But if you're not going to have a case on these kids, which you're not, that's the design of this bill, why are you having these reports sent to the court? It's also creating a workload for police officers in the field who are going to have to be making these reports to juvenile court, and then juvenile court people are going to have to sit around and figure out what to do with these reports. If the purpose of the bill is to allow police officers, law enforcement officers, to be clear on their powers. You don't need this. Because if you want to take the kid to a shelter and leave the kid at the shelter, you don't need to be making all these reports that nobody's ever going to follow up on. So rather than burden law enforcement, juvenile departments, and juvenile courts, I would like to see that section removed. I would like to say in terms of the custodial interference, if there is a report of a runaway, the person who harbors that runaway is committing custodial interference in the second degree, which is a C felony. And that's the law today. That doesn't need to be. If my daughter, age 9, runs away and goes next door, and I say to my next-door neighbors, I want my daughter home, and they say, well, we just don't think your daughter should come home, and I report it to Senator Tarno, who's the sheriff in my county, and he goes and knocks on their door, they are guilty of this Class C felony of custodial interference. There has to be the report. There has to be the run report. But they are guilty of that. And if they're permanently intending to keep my daughter, they're guilty of custodial interference in the first degree, a Class B felony. So that is on the books today. I guess the major thing I'd like to say in closing is that this is a good bill. We should have it. But I don't even think it gets us to B. I think that this body needs to take the responsibility to look at some other states over the interim. There are states like Washington which have very tough bills for status offenders where they can take a status offender into custody and lock him or her up for 6 months as long as the parent is engaged in a treatment program, because that's what's the problem here. The problem here is not a bunch of kids who just woke up one morning and decided to be bad. The problem here is we have problems between parents and children that can be solved. It's not the parents' fault. It's not the kids' fault. We need to work with families to get these kids off the street and back to their families. So I would urge this committee to consider somehow, some way, some kind of a task force to look at what other states are doing about this, because it's not good enough to have a child taken to a shelter, dropped off, and able to walk out the back door 10 seconds later. That's what this bill is about. Good bill should pass. Questions?
Yes, sir. Yes,
sir. Tim, why did the House object to having the information put in the list?
You know, I don't know, because that was never suggested that it go into LEDs.
It seems the only appropriate thing to do, considering that a kid may take off from Coos Bay and end up in Portland someplace, and may go from there over to some other city in the state of Oregon. And LEDs is the only repository.
That's
right. It's a central repository.
That's right, Senator Thomas.
And Mr. Chair, that was kind of my concern too. Why wouldn't we have a report? There has to be some report somewhere on these kids to keep track of.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cheatham, if the report were going to be used for something or being sent to a useful place, that's one thing. But the reports that are required here are going to go into wastebaskets. And again, why have
so
people making out...
So the ledge is what would help to solve that. So
well, yeah, if it goes someplace useful.
Because I think we do need to keep track of who these kids are. Can't just put them in a shelter. That can't lock them up. You know, it's the same thing as going to the neighbor's house. And by the way, I think probably a lot of parents don't know that it's illegal for some other family to harbor your child. And, you know, if you're not acquainted and have not had interface with law enforcement in any way, and believe me, there are a lot of upper middle class and middle class families that have kids that run away that have never had an interface with law enforcement. They don't have the slightest idea that this kid living seven blocks down the street, that they have any power to bring them back.
Yes, well, Mr. Chair, Senator Cheatham, one of the things that frequently happens in runaway situations is that a child will run away to a friend's house. And sometimes that works out very well because the parent and the other parent work something out so that the child is safe and can stay there. Other times these two parents go to war with one another over whether or not that kid's going to come home. But very rarely does anybody invoke the power that is present to do something about it.
Another question?
Well, that's just a statement, Mr. Chair. If we're going to go forward, I'd like to see some amendments that address the ledge issue.
Okay. Thank you for that.
can't. The other thing that was brought up, Mr. Chair, was that this issue of homeless versus runaway. In some ways, I am a little bit reluctant to have homeless named. And I guess just because I sense there are a lot of the homeless kids are homeless because they simply choose to be. But I guess then they would be called a runaway.
Okay.
But, are we just building homeless shelters?
Senator Bryant, there are a large number of kids on the street who have aged out of foster care. By the age of 14 or 15, they have left foster care and they are on the streets. And the agency can't do any, SCF can't do anything about pulling them back. They're out there.
Pioneer Square is full of them.
Right. Yes, it is, Senator. That's another large segment of kids on the street is kids who have aged out of foster care.
Well, we'll do some work on this bill and bring it back. Thanks for your testimony.
Thanks.
We'll close it in the public hearing on 2599. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2392. Mr. Kemp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. House Bill 2392 was a bill that originally was designed to prohibit someone from receiving diversion for a drunk driving arrest if they cause property damage. And the bill right now, or the law right now, says that if you cause personal injury, you are prohibited from entering diversion. That was the original idea. The House Judiciary Committee looked at this and decided that they didn't want to adopt that policy choice, but as an alternative, they drafted this bill or amended it to say that the victim of a property damage situation should be notified of a hearing concerning diversion and be allowed the opportunity to speak at the hearing. It's going to be a decision by a judge, a discretionary decision by the judge. But that is the bill that was passed out of committee and passed by the House and is to you now to basically give the victim of property damage the right to be notified of a diversion hearing and to speak at the diversion hearing before the court makes a decision about whether or not someone should be allowed in this circumstance, which involved crashing their car into something and causing property damage, if in that circumstance they should be allowed to enter diversion. So I just simply was here today to explain to you what the bill was. If you happen to answer any questions.
Any questions? Normally what happens in these cases, they sometimes damage their own cars, too.
Yes, but this bill is focused on damage to property of a person other than the defendant. But they will probably have some damage to their own car as well. That's correct.
Was it the DA's position that you should deny diversion if there was property damage to someone?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We've had a number of situations where you'll have collisions involving other vehicles, and just by happenstance, someone is not injured. But there can be serious damage done, and we thought the policy choice was that someone who is intoxicated to the point that they are actually getting in collisions with other vehicles or hitting houses, destroying property to that type of point, that they do have a serious drinking problem and that the diversion perhaps should not be authorized, just as it is not when someone is actually physically injured. But we're not here trying to amend back the original bill. We're just explaining how the process and how the House got to this point. We support the bill as it's printed and presented to you.
Mr. Taylor has a question.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mr. Penn, this bill talks about the victim having the right to be heard. When we get into the victim's rights legislation, oftentimes that right is really with the district attorney. Here, is this a right that only the victim can exercise, or is this a right that the district attorney can also exercise on behalf of the victim, without the victim saying you have the right to do so?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Taylor, I see this just as the right of a victim to speak at sentencing. That isn't something that a district attorney has a right to exercise. I certainly have a right to speak at sentencing, and I have a right to speak at this diversion hearing and to make a presentation to the court. But this is a right to the victim themselves. I have a duty under this statute to advise the victim of the date of the hearing. And so I know there are certainly are procedural issues where perhaps a district attorney would be the one to assert that right, but I see this as something personal to the victim of the property damage.
Thank you. I don't have a quorum at the moment. Okay. We'll close this public hearing on House Bill 2392. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2392. Thank you. Senator Tarnow moves House Bill 2392, Angros, for due pass. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. Carried. Thank you. We also had, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2494. Mr. Maddox testified on this. There were no other witnesses. This includes disabled people under the protection of elderly. And I said there were no others, but I know Ellie's here. Were you here to testify, Ellie, on 2464? Pardon? You're Ruth. I'm sorry. Okay, you are. Okay, Ruth, come on up. Let's go back and then to a public hearing on 2464.
The need for protection, I'm Bruce Smith from Salem. The need for protection for people with disabilities was brought to our attention through the Disability Services Office in an interagency meeting with the different police departments and the district attorney's office and the Marion County Mental Health Division. And through this, we found that there was problems in the court system of people with disabilities having court procedures done in such a way that if they couldn't communicate properly, sometimes the case was thrown out of court. And we wanted to find some way to make sure that this doesn't happen in the future. And therefore, we have asked that Senate Bill or House Bill 2464 be submitted to include people with disabilities in the bills that are already set aside for the elderly so that people with disabilities would have the same protection. And therefore, we were brought it to Representative Mannix, and he submitted this for us. And in the House, it passed with a 58 yes with two absent. And so therefore, we feel that this is a bill that people are really interested in and would like to see it passed through the Senate.
Thank you. Questions for Ruth? Thank you for being patient and waiting for us today. Dale Penn also would like to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney. The DA's Association is in support of this bill. We believe that the expansion to allow for protective orders not only for elderly persons, but people who meet the definition of disabled under the statute is a wise policy choice, and we would support the passage of the bill.
Thank you. With that, then, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2464. Open the work session on House Bill 2464.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2464A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Cusa moves House Bill 2464, absent growth, to the floor with due pass. Discussion? Objection? So on. Senator, would you carry the bill?
I will.
Thank you.
We'll
now open the public hearing on House Bill 2555, and I have no hope of reading this name correctly. Welcome.
I have a difficult name in person.
If you could give your name, please, for the record.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Dettinger. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem with the law firm of Garrett Heeman, Robertson, Paulus, James, and Comstock. I'm also on the executive committee for the family law section of the Oregon State Bar, and I'm one of their legislative liaisons this session. Today I'm appearing in support of House Bill 2555. What House Bill 2555 does is eliminates what's called the Enhanced Earning Capacity Statute. As it now stands, the courts of the state of Oregon can value a professional degree, license, or diploma if the other party in the divorce has participated in helping the educated spouse obtain their education. What you hear stereotypically is the spouse who puts the other spouse through medical school and then they get divorced right after after graduation. Some kind of benefit has been created, but there's no income source there to substantiate a large value. So what the courts can do now is they can say, how much is that education, how much is that diploma worth to the educated spouse, value it as property today, and consider it in the division of property just as you would a car or a house or a retirement plan. That gets difficult in that you are valuing something today with really no knowledge of what's going to happen in the future. What this does is rewrite the spousal support statute to allow for the court to award compensatory spousal support. Compensatory spousal support contains a lot of the same factors that the Enhanced Earning Capacity Statute does. It would make compensatory spousal support more difficult to modify because traditionally courts are hesitant and in most cases are absolutely prohibited from modifying property division. It's a good step in a very confusing area of law. I'll answer any questions that you might have, but the Oregon State Bar and the Family Law Section supports this bill.
Now, I imagine you have to bring in some sort of an expert in order to establish the value. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. I'm correct, sir.
Aaron, we have some dash two amendments that are conflict amendments. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. As members will see, because of the passage of Senate Bill 29, Governor signed that into law that would eliminate all the temporary language that's in the bill. That's the conflict amendment, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Committee, any questions of this witness? Thank you for your testimony. We'll then close the public hearing on House Bill 2555. And for those who are alert, we've lost our quorum. And so we can't go into work session. And what I'm going to do, we had two other bills, House Bill 3265, but I don't have anyone signed up to testify on that. And the other one was House Bill 2398 with Dale Penn and Ingrid Swenson testifying. We'll have a public hearing as a subcommittee to take public testimony. I need to step out again and go to the High Desert Museum reception, but since it we don't have a quorum anyway, it isn't presidential. This will be our last bill. So, Senator Tarno, if you could take over the gavel for me, we'll open the public hearing, then on 2398, and Dale and Ingrid, please.
Well, Ingrid, you take off first, but I think that'd be appropriate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are opposed to House Bill 2398. The implied consent law, of course, is a sort of understood contract between the drivers in the state of Oregon and the state. And in order to drive a vehicle in this state, it's assumed that you agree under certain circumstances as part of that privilege that you will either submit to a breath or blood or urine test under certain circumstances, or that you will suffer penalties for failing to do so. When that law was passed in Oregon, I think part of the understanding was that there would be limitations on the kinds of evidence that could be used in cases involving substances that were tested under the implied consent law, so that the state had to comply with the provisions as much as the individual did. One of the areas that has been contentious for years, and there have been bills in many previous sessions which would accomplish basically what House Bill 2398 does, has to do with people who are in accidents or otherwise injured during the course of a vehicle accident, and they are taken to the hospital. And for whatever reason, sometimes a police officer is not aware who might have been driving the vehicle among the people who were injured. Emergency personnel arrive before the police do, and the investigation isn't complete. So for lots of reasons, the police may not have arrived at reasonable suspicion or probable cause to believe that a particular individual was driving the vehicle and was under the influence of alcohol. So they get lost, in a sense. Now, sometimes a person goes to the hospital and is part of treatment. A blood sample is drawn in order to determine what substances are in the blood and also to look for issues related to the health of the patient. And the real issue raised by this bill is against that patient's will, and sometimes under this bill, without that patient's knowledge or consent that his or her blood is being drawn, can you use that medical evidence to prosecute this person? The public policy reason for not doing that, I think the most important one, is that we certainly do not wish to discourage people from seeking medical care if they need it. And if we don't protect their privacy interest in their medical records, in their bodily fluids, in the things that are part of being treated in a medical facility, you discourage people, obviously, in some circumstances, from seeking out those services. And that's one of the reasons our medical records are confidential. It's not the business of the public, what happens between you and the doctor who is treating you. The other issue, I guess, which has always been critical in this discussion is the fact, and the doctors aren't here, and presumably if they were concerned, they would be here. They have been here in every previous session because, of course, they become witnesses. When they are the ones who drew the blood, when they are the ones who arranged to have the blood taken to the laboratory, when they are the ones who had the blood tested and the results returned, they become witnesses. And they are subject to subpoena in pretrial motions and at trial. They become part of the chain of evidence. If you're going to use this evidence against them in the trial, then of course they're witnesses and they are subject to being dragged into court and required to discuss the circumstances of medical treatment. So for all of those reasons, we have opposed this bill in the past and we continue to oppose it.
I apologize. I should have Diego first to explain the bill. I didn't see it until he started talking.
Well, he always gets the last word, Mr. Chair, so it's nice to get at least the first.
Tim, go ahead, please.
Thank you. My name is Dale Tim, Marion County District Attorney. The DA Association does support this bill. I will advise you that on the House, I'm not aware of bills in the past, so I can't really speak to that. I will say that on the House side, the hospital associations were involved with this bill. They had no objection with it at all. And it really will not change any procedure from the hospital or the physician's perspective. Someone who comes into the hospital for treatment, they are always going to have a blood analysis done for diagnosis purposes. And the implied consent rules, I would echo what Ms. Swenson had to say about the reason for the prohibition of use of blood alcohol in the implied consent rules is that focusing on the breathalyzer results themselves. That's really the idea, is that if you refuse the breathalyzer, we want you to consent to a breathalyzer, but if you refuse that, well then there will be suspension activities about you, and you won't be able to use this breathalyzer result against you. Okay? Now, the reason for this bill is we believe that search warrant blood and medical blood have no part of this whole implied consent breathalyzer issue. Okay? That's really the philosophy behind this bill. If someone comes in and we determine or we discover later that there is hospital blood available, if it is otherwise competent, we believe that is evidence that's important and shows the truth of the situation and should be admissible in a case. And that's what this bill would allow. We run now into the situation where we will have a very serious accident and people will be injured and perhaps even deaths will result in that accident. It is not always possible for law enforcement to know immediately at the time when people are being transported by ambulances who was the driver at fault in this accident. And so let's just hypothesize that someone dies in this accident. The law is very clear that in any other kind of crime, except for drunk drive, any other kind of crime, medical blood is admissible. And search warrant blood is admissible. And so what we have to advise law enforcement now is, in these very serious accidents, it's necessary to go ahead and do search warrants so that if there is a manslaughter prosecution or criminal homicide prosecution or an assault prosecution, that we will have search warrant blood that would be admissible. And in those kinds of crimes, we can subpoena the hospital records now and get the medical blood analysis, so that's admissible in those crimes. But if we also charge drunk driving, we cannot use the search warrant blood or the medical blood to prove the drunk driving charge. And so we can have situations, and that just doesn't make sense, is really the reason for this bill. We have situations where perhaps there are people who die, and later it is determined that one of the person who died was actually the driver of the car that maybe went into the other lane. And so maybe they're the cause of this death. However, we also learn from the medical blood that both drivers are under the influence, or maybe the one who is, quote, not at fault was under the influence. And yet, because of the way the law is set, we would have medical blood showing us that this other driver was under the influence. Maybe they're not the cause of the death, and so they shouldn't be prosecuted for the manslaughter or the assault charge, but they are driving on the highways of Oregon under the influence. And in a moral sense, it may be that because they are under the influence, they were unable to prevent this collision that resulted in other people's death. But we believe they should be prosecuted for driving under the influence, because that's in fact what is the truth, and that's the charge that they should be prosecuted for. But again, we're not able to use the medical blood. And most of the time in this scenario, they aren't able to be given a breathalyzer test because they're going through these medical processes. They might have injuries themselves, and the police are not going to be able to stop treatment and say, hey, we need to take you over to the police station to take a breathalyzer. So the whole implied consent process doesn't make sense in these scenarios. So that's the reason for the bill. There's no question but the medical blood is an accurate statement of blood alcohol level. There is no question that in a search warrant scenario, there's probable cause, and that's a court order to say that this blood alcohol level should be authorized for the state to review. We're just simply saying that let's prevent this kind of illogical situation where manslaughter, criminal homicide, assault charges, you can use medical blood and search warrant blood. But if you have a charge of drunk drive attached to those, you can't use that evidence for the drunk drive. Or if you have the scenario where there are deaths, but let's say this person is under the influence, was not the actual cause of the accident, again, you can't use this blood evidence against them for a drunk driving charge. So that's what the bill is, and That's the reason for submitting it to.
Okay. Questions to Mr. Penn or Ingrid? She's already testified on this issue. Apparently not. Folks, thank you very much. It seems that we did something within the area of blood in 95, I thought, in the way of blood testing in a hospital situation.
Mr. Chair, I think what happened was, if I'm wrong, correct me, but that was the measure which allowed doctors to report to police officers that they suspected someone was
good memory.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. We're going to adjourn for the day since everybody's gone.
And we're hungry.
I'm hungry.
So the family law bill didn't move. Was there somebody here to testify on it?
Penny was here.
Oh, good. Well, I told Gewirtz I'd read his letter, but I don't have it in the file, so.
Lighter than the big one,
then. I'll have to look and see. I didn't see it in there.
Okay. Maybe get rough down here next time.
Yeah. I see, but he'll have time to move it.